Welcome to the Mountain Rain Zen Dharma Podcast, featuring talks by our guiding teachers, Myoshin Kate McCandless and Shinmon Michael Newton, as well as other members of our community. Find out more about us and how to support our work at mountainrainzen.org.
I was just telling somebody earlier this morning, it feels like spring has retreated for a little while in this cold, dank weather that we've been having. And yet, so lush out there, the greens. I noticed driving in today from Mission, many of the trees are almost in full leaf and everywhere verdant. I'd like to maybe start with an apology, because most of the talk that I'm going to be giving today is one I've done before, but not for Mountain Rain. Kate and I are helping out Seattle Soto Zen. Seattle Soto Zen is a kind of sibling sangha, along with Red Cedar. And right now they're holding a practice period with a shuso. And Kate and I went down there for the opening. The priest at Seattle, it doesn't have full transmission. In other words, not a brown robe, but black robe. And so for some obscure historical reason, you need to have a brown robe to do the opening and the closing of the ceremony. So Kate and I agreed, of course, to drive down and help them out with that and to give a couple of talks. The Kate will be giving a talk before long via Zoom. Chikyo Yuen, who some of you remember from the Mountain Rain retreats, session that we've had, is head monk for Seattle Soto Zen, and Kate and I have been working with him. So the talk I'm going to give now is the talk that I gave last week to them via Zoom. Chikyo Yuen, being Shuso, gets to kind of more or less decide what he wants to talk about. He gives a little series of classes on Tuesday. He's the head monk, remember, and he chose this book that he wanted to talk about, and it's called The Taste of Silence, How I Came to Be at Home with Myself. You want to just hold it up to the, It looks like pretty good. It's a rather unusual book, one I had not heard of before. Yuen brought it to our attention. But I wanted my talk that I gave to the Seattle Soto Zen to also help support Yuen. So I picked a chapter from this book and spoke about it. So the title of the book, Taste of Silence, How I Came to Be at Home with Myself. And it's by a Belgium author, Beek van der Kerkhof is her name. And throughout the book, she writes on her experience of silence as a source of deep meaning and healing as she faced a life with ALS. She was diagnosed with ALS as a young adult, still at university or college, and became paralyzed from the pelvis up gradually as ALS continued to manifest itself. And maybe let's talk a little bit more about her during the talk. any rate, in the second chapter of this book, van der Kerkhove tells about the deep influence of the writings of a woman, Etty Hillesum, who was a Dutch writer of letters and diaries who died at Auschwitz concentration camp. She writes about how important this book and the writings were as she dealt with her own struggles. Van der Kerkhove wrote, "Years later, after spending many hours of quiet time, I began to understand the value and truth of her words," talking about Etty, "her words pointing to a path of silence, just as in Zen." Etty writes somewhere, "Thinking never quite does it. Thinking never quite does it." I suspect that many of us here have come to the same conclusion. Thinking never quite does it when we're dealing with the great sufferings of this life. No matter how long or how hard we try to think our way through something like this, thinking doesn't quite do it. In the second chapter, van der Kerkhove writes that her own path and Etty's path and Zen's path is the path of silence. After her diagnosis with ALS, just by the recommendation of her friend to start with, van der Kerkhove spent much time in Benedictine monasteries. But she also, a little bit later, started to practice Zen. And indeed, she was given a formal transmission, in other words, to become a Zen teacher in a Chinese lineage before she died. Reading her comments, I wondered, what is the silence of Zen? And I thought, well, the silence of Zen is practiced in many ways. One answer may be that we create quiet when we come and sit here in the Zendo. We sit in Zazen. We create quiet when we eat our oidoki meals, our formal meals at Sesshin. We create quiet when we participate in work practice, or we go for walks during the shorter Sesshin or shorter retreats or long Sesshin. But of course, that's not complete. There is an inner quiet, an inner silence that is always present, and yet so hard to describe, and sometimes so hard to find. Dogen, the Japanese monk who brought this form of Zen practice from China way back in the 1200s to Japan, writes of taking the backward step and shining the light inward. An expression maybe you've heard before, once or twice during a Dharma talk, or if you've read Dogen. In his essay, the Fukon Zazengi, which we chant sometimes at longer retreats, Sesshin, he wrote this: "You should therefore cease from the practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words, and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will be manifest." When I reread this, when I was kind of preparing the talk, I thought, you know, stepping backwards sounds rather strange in English. And to me, it has kind of a negative connotation. right? Like perhaps to stop doing what you're doing or stop trying to gain something, step back from it. We speak of stepping up, speaking in the right direction, a step forward, a step ahead, a step above the rest, be in step, get in step with the times, to step up, to take steps. And these are generally positive, have a positive aspect to them. And of course, there are a couple I could think of, like with negative expressions using step as well. Like, do you want to step outside, buddy? Or step on someone's foot, right? Step out of line. I remember way back when I first read Dogen's Take the Backward Step, I immediately thought of a comic scene in a movie or TV show, right? Where you have the army sergeant ask for a volunteer to step forward, and all the soldiers take one step back, except for the lone rookie. Anyone here watch Hogan's Heroes on TV? Some of you are too young for Hogan's Heroes. But that kind of thing would happen at that show. Take a step back as an instruction is really quite different from how meditation is usually approached. Most forms of meditation that I'm familiar with have a focus or a purpose, as is true in most of the activities that we do, of course, in our daily life, right? I want to develop concentration. I want to calm my heart, the emotions, to relax the body, become fully absorbed in the divine, however we understand that. Develop a stability, calmness, so I can face life's challenges, maybe even become more intimate with the world. We have a goal, a kind of focus in front of us. And really, that's very natural, because everyone comes to practice at first with a goal in mind. Because after all, isn't that how we begin all our activities? Signing up to work out in a gym, taking high school French class, joining a book club, buying a bike repair manual. There's something in all those activities that we kind of are aiming for. And beginning Zen practice is a little different. We have a goal, something. I mean, why come here and sit facing a wall for half an hour, watching the paint? And it's not even wet paint. It's already dry. Entering the Zendo, receiving some instruction, settling down on our cushion, a bench, or chair. I think as beginners, we all hold, strongly or weakly, a goal or vision of what we want, where we want our hearts, our mind to be, how we want our life to change. And even if we cannot articulate it well, there is some dissatisfaction, discomfort, or suffering we wish to be free of. However, after we become established in our Zen practice, we all need to recognize that the goal or vision that brought us here in the Zendo, that goal is somehow lodged, I think, kind of in the forefront of our mind, nestled right beside our sense of self, our ego, and our mental map of the world, how things are. Once that practice, our Zen practice, is established, in other words, we're coming regularly, we kind of have dealt with some of the issues that have brought us here, that goal or that vision actually becomes a hindrance, an obstacle to the fullness of your being coming forward. You may say our imagined goal blocks our opening to the reality of our life as it is. Dogen tells us to take the backward step. He's telling us step into the quiet, deep, boundless awareness that is always present. We may call it step into the background of your mind, that vast awareness that holds all the thought. Thoughts appear in this awareness, like bubbles popping up on a pond. And these thoughts distract us from this awareness of our awareness. And that awareness is unobtrusive and unreactive. Unfortunately, there's no switch to flick, no infallible technique to follow so that we can just be aware of the awareness. It's a matter of not making effort, but rather, as Vanda Kirchhoff experienced in her book, of residing in silence, both in inner and in outer silence. Or as the contemporary Japanese Soto Zen Roshi, Uchiyama Roshi expressed it, he says, we open the hand of thought and experience the reality of life. What he's saying is that when we're engaged in thought, we're not experiencing the reality of our life. We're experiencing the reality of our thoughts. When we open the hand of thought, all that's there is your life, complete, whole, expressing itself fully. Thoughts come, but we're not engaged in them. Coming back to this awareness. It is that silent place with its openness and clarity that we really touch the mystery that is beyond what we imagined. Whatever brought us here. You come here for enlightenment? Right? Perhaps you have an idea of, oh, yeah, it's going to be like this. During Zazen, period after period, day after day, it may seem that nothing happens, except maybe some stillness, silence, sense of timelessness. But each time awareness sinks deeply inwardly, each time we take the backward step, the shine step into the background of our mind, we touch a truth that has always been present. But largely unseen, unrecognized, because we are so caught up in our thinking. We touch the truth of interbeing, of one's universal or Buddha nature. And maybe you have had intimations of this. While, for example, on a long hike on the North Shore, maybe working in the garden, maybe just sitting down having a cup of tea looking out the window, riding a bike. It is your birthright, after all, this vast awareness. Zen practice prepares each of us for entering deeply the truth of no separate self, of a vast awareness that is free of assumptions, judgments, the parsing that goes on constantly in the forefront of our minds. I should mention, maybe before I go too much further, I have no knowledge of how the brain works. I'm using forefront and background as metaphors. But let me just go back to the book, Vanda Kirchhoff's book, for a moment. She writes this. 2 years long, I search for a way out of my despair. Imagine being, I think she was 19 or 20, and ALS. Nothing worked. I no longer knew where else I could look. At that low point, I had lost everything. I thought this was the end. A bit later, in the same section, she writes, "But if all you have left is tears, thinking doesn't do much for you. When I fell ill, I thought and read until I was groggy with fatigue, searching for meaning. I had to and would find an answer." Well, what she found in her search and her deep looking and journey was not an answer. But she entered ever more deeply into silence, and in there found the fullness of her life. At the end of the second chapter, she writes, "I no longer look for answers. I only look for silence. Silence allows something wonderful to be born." Well, it sounds like she found a way out of her suffering, but that's not quite right. Van der Kerkhove continues, "The way of silence is tough and a difficult path. Hopelessness, hopeless misery remains hopeless misery. A wall remains a wall, and living with that is no laughing matter. And yet, there is something else. I simply cannot do without silence, time and again." I think it's quite moving and beautiful here. Van der Kerkhove does not give us an answer how to end the trials and tribulations of life. But she hints, like a good Zen teacher, there is something else. Misery, yeah, your life is going to have misery. What was the expression? Hopeless misery, no less. It's going to remain hopeless misery. And yet there is something else. I think many of you here have heard of Shohaku Okumura. He's the founder and guiding teacher of the Sanshin Zen community in Bloomington, Indiana. And he's written several wonderful books on Soto Zen practice. And he has for many years taught extensively on Dogen, Dogen's writings. Wonderful translator and powerful teacher. Kate and I practiced with Shohaku for several years when we lived in Kyoto, when Shohaku was also there. He was our first Soto Zen teacher, and we're deeply grateful to him for introducing us to this practice. Anyway, here's a story I want to tell you about Shohaku. Shohaku, after training for some years in Japan as a young man, came to Massachusetts in the early 1970s to help establish a small practice center in the woods there with a group of other monks from the temple he trained at, Taiji, in Kyoto. And life was really challenging. There was no financial support from Japan, and all the monks worked hard on the land. They had to dig a well, you know, build the buildings. They did everything by themselves. And at the same time, they had to have jobs to get some money coming in. So you can imagine, 24/7 practically, work. And after 3 years, Shohaku developed severe neck and back pain. And since he had no medical insurance or money for medical treatment, he had to return to Japan, physically, as he writes, half broken. I was bewildered and didn't know what to do. My biggest problem was that I could not practice as I had for the last 10 years because of my physical condition. He couldn't sit. I didn't know how to live outside of practice. So here's, you know, an ordained monk. Can't do it. But then Shohaku writes something very insightful about this time. He writes, I realized that my belief that practice was the best and most meaningful way of life was nothing more than arrogance of youth and health. That's why I was at a loss when I could no longer practice that way because of my health. I wanted to live a better life than ordinary people. I saw clearly that my practice had not been for the sake of Buddha Dharma, but for my own self-satisfaction. So Shohaku struggled for some time. But then one day, he sat down on a cushion in his apartment without any reason or desire, just decided he'd start to sit again. And then he took the backward step. He writes, after his experience of sitting down again, he writes, I could just sit as much as my physical condition allowed. Finally, I felt free of my understanding of the Buddha's teachings and my desire to be a good monk. I felt free to be myself and nothing more. I was still a deluded, ordinary human being with ignorance and desires, but when I sat and let go of thoughts, I was, or more precisely, my zazen was, free of ignorance and selfish desires. So I think for Shohaku, there was this shift from the forefront to the background of his mind. This good monk, right? Do zazen. Hours and hours a day of zazen. Do night, do yaza, do night sitting. Hours and hours of zazen. There was a shift. He deeply experienced the teachings of his own teacher, Utsuyama, to open the hand of thought. Now, you may think, yes, I want that too. I want to get to that place that Shohaku experienced. I want to get to the great silence that van der Kerkhove speaks of, and I want to get there ASAP. But please wait a moment. As I mentioned earlier, when we start practice, we almost always come with a problem, right? Something is bothering us. We come to relieve something. Siddhartha Gautama, a prince, no less, with all his cares taken care of by an indulgent father. Right. You want musicians? Here are musicians. You want good food? Here's good food. You want dancing girls? Here's dancing girls. You want a beautiful garden? Here's a beautiful garden. He still left his palace and became a wandering mendicant to search for an answer to the universal suffering that he saw all around in the village when he went out, according to the mythology at least. And all the biographies of the great Zen ancestors begin with, at least most of them, I shouldn't say all, but most, begin with a personal challenge that a particular ancestor had that brought that ancestor to practice. Whatever problem you have can be the spark of what's called Bodhi mind or way-seeking mind, it brings us to this practice. This is the energy with which we seek the truth of our lives. And I hasten to add, as a person who has practiced for many years, there may be one problem that brings you here to the Zendo, but there will be many others that keep you coming, keep you on the cushion. Remember Shohaku's story, right? 10 years he practiced as a young monk in Japan, and then still facing a terrible problem, he came back. But that's okay, because your life is boundless, wonderful, and life's problems are boundless. But that's wonderful too, it keeps us practicing. How could there be an end to practice and to insight that arises? Shakyamuni Buddha's first teaching when he awoke is known as the Deer Park Sermon. And that's where he expounded on the Four Noble Truths, which I'm sure everyone here has heard of, by addressing the existence of suffering, the cause of suffering, and its end, and the fact that it can end, and here's how to do it. Those are the Four Noble Truths. Now, the cause of suffering is expressed in little different ways, but basically it's what is often translated as thirst or desire, wanting something, craving something. And we don't have time to really unpack this today, but I wanted to point out a contradiction that the Second Noble Truth highlights for our own practice, for your practice here. The desire to practice, as I mentioned, is kind of the Bodhi mind or the way-seeking mind. That's kind of our impetus, our motivation for practice. And the contradiction that we need to face when we sit down and practice for a while is that the desire that's at the very heart of the way-seeking mind or the Bodhi mind, that desire itself is a cause of suffering. The strong desire for truth, the desire and the strong desires for profit, fame, pleasure are really not so different. We can get caught, and many people, not many, but I've seen people, usually younger people, you know, sweating blood on the cushion, like, you know, doing hours and hours of zazen that I want that awakening. I want that satori experience. But that too is a desire. We feel a lack and we want to make an effort to fulfill it. But as we saw with Shohaku's example, it's not a matter of getting something. It's a matter of letting go. And it's hard to let go. Our practice is not to escape the sufferings of this life, but to be able to be and practice in the very middle of the sufferings of our life. Van der Kerkhove did not escape the sufferings of ALS. And yet, as we read the book, it's very clear in a profound way she was free. To be free of something and to escape or eliminate it, I think, are two very different things. I know I will not escape from the suffering we all share as part of humanity. Sickness, old age, and death, I see no way out for me. And I imagine the same is true for you as well. the way that van der Kerkhof discovered, the way our Soto Zen practice is simply entering into that deep silence and resting in that silence, opening the hand of thought. And this silence is not just a quiet mind, although those moments are very sweet. It is repeatedly opening the hand of thought, not engaging with the endless thoughts that arise over and over and over again, but gently returning to the body, to the breath, returning to here, now. In our Zazen practice, we let go of our stories. We let go of our judging of good and bad, our philosophical understandings of the Dharma. Let it go. We just let them go. And we open our hands minute after minute as we sit in our Zazen. And then in this Zazen, we come to see the reality before separation, before our common view of me and everything else that dominates our life. I think we come to know that we live with the support of all beings. We come to know we too are woven into this dynamic interpenetration of this universe that is constantly flowing. That is the silence, I think, of Zen. I know I have spoken for too long, but I want to end with a poem. Keeping Quiet by Pablo Neruda, famous poem. Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still, for once on the face of the earth. Let us not speak in any language. Let us stop for a second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would not look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence may interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Now I will count to 12, and you will keep quiet, and I will go.
You've been listening to the Mountain Rain Zen Dharma Podcast. These talks are made possible thanks to donations from our worldwide community. If you find value in these teachings, please consider supporting our work. Visit mountainrainzen.org/donate.